Welcome to the Med Device Cyber Podcast, the podcast that dives into the critical world of medical device cybersecurity. I'm your host, Christian Espinoza, joined by my colleague, Trevor Slattery. Each week, we explore the latest trends, share expert insights, and discuss real-life stories that highlight the importance of protecting the devices we trust with our health. Whether you're a manufacturer, regulatory affairs professional, or a concerned loved one, this podcast is for you. Let's get started.
Welcome back to the Med Device Cyber Podcast, joined here by the Blue Goat CEO and the co-host Christian Espinoza. And we have a guest today, Craig. Craig, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So my name is Craig Ingram. People call me Craig T. I got that nickname a few years ago when I was able to speak at a business conference with Kiefer Sutherland and Kevin Costner. So that's how they gave me this little nickname. So it's kind of interesting. But 27 years in the medtech industry, I started my own medical distribution company when I was a sophomore in college. And then went to Johnson & Johnson and then started my venture capital supported career from back to back multiple companies over the years. And recently, over the last year and a half, I have been doing med tech and healthcare technology consulting to companies to help prevent them, to be quite honest, from going broke. The statistics are very, very high for startup and mid-stage small, medium enterprise companies of shutting their doors just because of low amounts of customer adoption, unfortunately, because commercialization is more of an art than a science. And unfortunately, the deck of cards are stacked against companies when they form and try to commercialize their products and services they offer.
Thanks for the intro. And it seems like almost everybody had worked at one of the large organizations. The previous guest on our podcast had worked at Johnson & Johnson as well. So it seems like everyone's coming from Stryker or Johnson & Johnson or something.
Yeah. I mean, those are the large strategics, right? So they're the ones that take a gamble on people that don't have a lot of experience, right, to gain that experience. And without those large strategics that you know, literally bring in billions and billions and billions of dollars annually, very few companies would gamble on somebody fresh out of college or in college, even.
Yeah. Something you said in the intro, it's interesting to me, because I would think from a business roadmap perspective, if I'm a startup, I'm getting investors, I would have thought about the customer adoption of, client adoption of my product early on, right? Isn't that part of what investors look at? And isn't that something that should be thought of? Because, I mean, if you don't understand your total addressable market and how it's going to be used and how you're going to get it to that market, then, like you said, you have a pretty high degree of failure, right? Like, isn't that pretty typical, though, in an early startup's roadmap?
They're going to tell you yes. But just like a car that's not running well and the mechanic will look under the hood and start tinkering around with the engine, that's what my company does. We lift up the hood and inspect the engine of the company. And we find that 9 out of 10 companies do not have a commercialization roadmap or plan. They have a business plan. They may have a sales plan. They may have a marketing plan, but the sales plans and the marketing plans fit into an overall commercialization plan. And very few companies can literally pull one out that they've created and typed out and is in written format. And yes, that is what investors look at. But when people think of commercialization, they only think of marketing, meaning to let their total addressable market know the products and services they offer, and then selling, which unfortunately, the vast majority of sales professionals and even the leadership sales professionals are showing and telling. They're not actually selling and using the psychology of selling to get the potential prospect or potential customer to rationalize why they should own the product or service that's being offered.
So the psychology of selling, and I've heard this before, people talk about, you know, the product and the features, but they don't really understand like how that solves the problem for the the prospect and look at it through the prospect's, you know, lens. And there's some psychology behind that. Obviously, it's emotional intelligence.
Oh, it's even beyond that, right? It's using emotional persuasion dialogue or emotional persuasion messaging in a way that attracts.
What does that mean? Emotional? Because we do social engineering and cybersecurity, which is sort of conning people using some of these techniques. I'm just curious, like emotional. I think you said emotional persuasion dialogue.
Yeah. So emotional persuasion dialogue has to do with tonality, the words used, and the total framework of the sentence, of the questions that are being asked and the conversation that is being enacted with a prospect, right? Because they're not really a customer until they buy. And once they're a customer, then the goal of that company is to turn them into a client, right? Customers buy once, but clients buy over and over again. And so the biggest challenge with effective commercialization is multifaceted. Number one, there's 10 components of commercialization. The vast majority of chief commercial officers don't know the 10 components. They don't. I've asked them. I've asked hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of chief commercial officers which component of the 10 commercialization do they struggle with the most? And the vast majority of the time, you can tell they're very uncomfortable answering that question because they're thinking it's just selling or marketing, but they don't think about regulatory. They don't think about product design, right? Or production or alliances and partnerships, right? They don't think of those different components. And when it comes to emotional persuasion dialogue, it's the messaging, it's the interaction with the customers, it's the interaction within the team, being able to understand what is being communicated to our audience that would A, attract them, B, make them want to learn more, and C, pull the trigger, pay for that product or service that's being offered. Too many corporate and company leaders don't think that way. Without customer adoption of the products and services they offer, companies go broke. And the data from the SBA, Small Business Administration, is up to 40% of companies are ever profitable. That's a problem. Out of that, there are 32.8 million small businesses in the United States. Now, that includes every industry, every size of company, everything from a revenue standpoint. But what the SBA has defined as a small company, and also there's not an investment firm, there's not a private equity organization that disagrees with this. But according to the SBA, a small business is considered 500 employees or less, no matter what the revenue is. The revenue could be $1 trillion a year, but if they have 500 employees or less, they're still considered a small business because it's not revenue-based, it's employee size-based. And so out of 32.8 million companies in the United States in 2024, for example, that employs 99.2% of the US population. But here's the problem. 50 to 55% of companies literally shut their doors because of low customer adoption of the products and services they offer within 5 years. 72 to 77% of companies shut their doors before they get to blow out their, you know, 10 candles for their 10th year anniversary. So the stack is the deck of cards are stacked against business success. And people say, well, Craig, business is more than just the financial success. No, it's not. Because if the business is not sustaining itself, it cannot serve the world in the products and services that these people need. So if a business is failing financially, it's always due to two things. low customer adoption of the products and services they offer, or mismanagement of expenses. That's what it boils down to.
Speaking of expenses, so one of the things that Trevor always says, and I'm curious your take as well, Craig, he always says that cybersecurity is a necessary evil because most organizations think it as an expense, that it doesn't actually add any value. I'm just curious, like your take, Craig, from your experience in the industry, do most medtech manufacturers think of cybersecurity as a necessary evil, or do they think, okay, this is a value add, so my device is going to be maybe adopted more because it's proven secure over somebody else's in a healthcare delivery organization?
Well, number one, it's not evil. What's evil is there's people's hearts and minds and motives that want to hack and crack into other people's secure lockbox in their company, let's say, and do something malicious, steal something that's not theirs. And so number one, it's not evil. It's critical. And is it an expense? Yeah. But so is insurance, right? Are people willing to gamble without health insurance, vehicle insurance, homeowners insurance? Cybersecurity, relatively speaking, is an inexpensive insurance to prevent somebody from breaking into your company's data house and stealing something that's not theirs. But because we have evil people in business where the word integrity is the latest buzzword, but they don't follow it, they're willing to walk into someone's home and steal their stuff. So cybersecurity is your armed guard to take care of your data home. So no, I don't think it's evil at all. I think it's critical. It's unfortunate we even have to have it, but we have to have it.
I wish people that we interacted with had the same view of things. It's often one of those things that's pushed to the back. And I like the analogy to insurance, and it even can tie right into cybersecurity, like ransomware insurance. That's something that has popped up recently. A lot of companies are having to get that, be compliant with that. To get ransomware insurance, there are a lot of boxes you have to tick. The same way to get health insurance at a decent rate. You can't be a smoker. You can't have heart conditions, stuff like that. If you want to get ransomware insurance, you need to do penetration tests. You need to have cybersecurity compliance in your product. And it is unfortunate that it's something that's required. But, you know, like you said, there are a lot of bad guys out there taking a look at how can we try to steal anything we can. Christian and I were just talking about how when you stand up a product or an AWS instance or something out on the internet, within like an hour, you've already gotten scanned 5,000 times. And that's no exaggeration. It's literally about 5,000 times. And so people are doing anything they can to just grab onto anything that's left out there. If it's not nailed down, someone will take it. And so, sure, it's inconvenient, it's expensive, there's a lot that goes into it, but is it more expensive to pay for a penetration test, or is it more expensive to, you know, get fined by violating HIPAA compliance, things like that? So a lot of, it's a balance, but, you know, obviously doing it right, it's the same as paying an insurance premium. You hope you never need it, but when you do need it, you're really happy that you got that penetration test. You have all those controls. You have your SOC 2 type 2, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. When we're dealing with people, you know, we deal with people that aren't perfect. And then we deal with people who choose to be malicious, right? There's a difference between accidental mistakes and intentional maliciousness. And I think from a standpoint of, you know, regulatory, for example. So regulatory is, or regulatory affairs is the third component of commercialization. And people go, well, what do you mean? Well, if you're in healthcare in any way, shape, or form, and you're going to be offering your product to a healthcare patient treatment entity, like a hospital, surgery center, you know, any long-term rehab facility, or even if it's somewhat potentially over the counter, you're dealing with regulatory processes, and you have to be cleared or approved in order to offer that product or service, you know, to the marketplace. And from a regulatory affairs standpoint, cybersecurity fits right in to commercialization component number three, and that's regulatory, right? Because you want to be compliant, because you mentioned HIPAA, right? Whether I agree with HIPAA or not, there's some rule. Like if I get cancer and somebody finds out I have cancer, who cares? You know, like it's not going to cure my disease, right? Like it doesn't matter to me. Who knows? What matters though is some of the intricate detail, like social security numbers and things like that, that it's attached to, that people can be malicious with. So yes, it's cybersecurity in a digital based age is 100% critical, especially in commercialization component number three, and that's regulatory affairs.
You know, I think you bring up a really great point there. When I'm first meeting someone, if they ask, you know, hey, what do you do? While, of course, what we're doing is cybersecurity, I typically default more to saying regulatory affairs. And the reason for that being is, you know, cybersecurity is, I guess, the action and regulatory affairs is the actual goal. Nobody would come to get cybersecurity services. No one would come to get penetration testing on their devices, have all the documentation that they need if it wasn't required by the regulations. Well, I won't say nobody. There are some manufacturers out there and they're super proactive about cybersecurity. Even if they have a cleared device and they've already done their annual pen test, they go, yeah, we're just, you know, want to be sure, stuff like that. And so I'm not saying it's an absolute rule, but it is all at the root of regulatory requirements. Penetration tests have to be done in a specific way. It has to be done this way for the FDA, has to be done this way for HIPAA, has to be done this way for SOC 2. So everything goes to those regulations, you know, at the core.
It's interesting, right? Because you think about cybersecurity, and you were just talking about when people say, well, what do you guys do? Who's Blue Goat Cyber, right? If you guys hired me as somebody to work on your commercialization, right, I would say, you know what we do? We prevent malicious activity and people from coming into your data house in your company. That's what we do. We are the Fort Knox for your data.
Yeah, so it's interesting because this is one of the conversations Trevor and I have quite a bit is and we've talked about HIPAA data a little bit, but from the FDA lens and from our lens, it's like the data is almost secondary. The real thing we look at is like, if I can hack into a medical device, what harm can I cause a patient? If it's a surgical robot, can I cause it to paralyze somebody? If it's an IVD system, can I cause it from a true positive diagnosis to a looks like a true negative for something like sepsis and, you know, kill somebody. You know, so we look at it through that lens, and it's like the data, you know, we have HIPAA and all that other stuff to protect the data supposedly, but the data is almost like secondary. I mean, it really is secondary to the patient harm. So I would always look at it through that lens. Yeah.
That's a great lens to look through, right? Let's be honest. Surgical robots are here to stay. Again, everybody can comment on, do they shorten recovery time? Do they give a patient a better outcome? There's valid points on both sides. But here's the truth. If a surgeon is at a council and they're doing surgery, and if somebody was able to hack in through the means necessary and take over the controls while the surgeon, and the surgeon is like fighting against the other person on the other line, let's be honest, trying to manipulate it, 100% that would cause harm. And so you're right. Cybersecurity is not just about data, but it's about preventing malicious activity, whatever that activity may be. There may be 4,000 different types of activities. And that's why it's important, right? And so as somebody who chooses to be a chief commercial officer, it is part of their job to make sure that cybersecurity is part of that commercialization strategy working obviously with the IT department and everything to make sure that there are safeguards in place, because whether it's the EU MDR, which is like the, you know, version of the US FDA, or the FDA here in the United States, for example, they're going to need to know that there's some type of Fort Knox security within that platform, whatever that platform may be. So yeah, it goes right hand in hand with effective commercialization.
Do you feel, because you've been in the industry quite some time, that
yes, I am old.
Manufacturers, that medical device manufacturers, med tech innovators have gotten better at cybersecurity and some of these like regulatory affairs that tie to cybersecurity, I guess?
Have they gotten better? Of course they have, right? Because it's part of the mandate that the regulatory bodies require, right? If there wouldn't have been a requirement, then it wouldn't be so forefront of people's mind, right? And so the goal is not to buy the cheapest, not to buy the most expensive, but to buy the program or work with the cybersecurity company that brings the best value for the buck, right? And so if somebody pays a dollar and they can get five things, and there's another company that you pay a dollar and you get two things, well, they're going to have to really look at the difference and go, do I need those extra three things, even though it's the same price? Will it add more complexity, right? People get confused between the word easy and simple, but simplicity doesn't mean easiness, and easiness doesn't mean simplicity. And so the goal is, what is going to bring the most simplistic yet most effective prevention of penetration possible into that medical device, into the clinical study process or data to mess with that clinical study, maybe for that biopharma drug that needs to come out. Maybe it's a lab test. Maybe it's a diagnostic tool, right? And that diagnostic tool is used live through the internet. So we have to prevent someone being able to take over or manipulate the data or take over the controls, like I was saying earlier in the medical device, you know, robotic situation.
Yeah. You brought up a couple of things I wanted to highlight, and then I'm going to throw it over to Trevor. One is, and I agree, basically you alluded to the fact that the guidance has come out. There's a mandate that makes people have to consider cybersecurity, because from my experience, nobody cares about cybersecurity unless there's a compliance driver, right? Or they've had a data breach or something.
Whether it's a compliance driver or not, they should care, because if they get in trouble, meaning if they get in trouble where their product ends up not working, well, the trouble is they're not going to get high rates of customer adoption. Trying to get high rates of customer adoption when everything's working perfectly is very, very, very difficult, right? So they should actually have this top of mind immediately.
Yeah. And then the second thing is, you're talking about, like, if I choose a vendor and I get, you know, spend a dollar and get five things versus a dollar and get two things. This is the challenge we have selling to the industry, is people don't know what they don't know. So it's a lot of consumer education through the process, because people will often choose, manufacturers will choose a traditional, I like to say traditional cybersecurity company that doesn't specialize in med tech. It doesn't understand the FDA or MDR. And then they do this testing and they get all these rejections when they submit their packet to the FDA because the cybersecurity company didn't do things appropriately, right? So it's like we try to teach that awareness, but it's still like this major challenge, because they think, oh, I spend a dollar, I get these five things, but they should spend the dollar and get two things from us, because the two things from us actually matter versus the five things that don't matter. So I'm just curious what your take is on that, Trevor, and then we'll throw it back over to Craig.
Yeah, I think that we see it's hard to hit that balance point. And, you know, The information on what you need to do is out there. The regulations that the FDA calls out that you need to follow are available. You can read what steps you need to go into a penetration test. But I don't think that all these manufacturers do it. They just want someone who already knows this stuff. They say, hey, we don't want to have to figure out how NIST Special Publication 800-115 guidelines work. That's a lot of reading and a lot of stuff about penetration testing that we don't want to do. Someone else should figure that out. And it kind of goes back to saying, you know, like that publication, that is the golden standard for the FDA. But if you're looking at HIPAA compliance, you don't have to follow the same guidelines that you do for an FDA test. You have to do other things. But it is, you know, if you're paying for a penetration test, you might get, like you said, these five things. And you really need these three things. And so these two things are bloat. And then the three things that they are providing aren't done properly. And so we'll get clients who say, well, yeah, we got, you know, the cheapest pen test we could find. It was just standard run-of-the-mill testing firm trying to test our device, and we got kicked back. What's going on? They'll send us their deficiency notice from the FDA. I'll read it, and, you know, it says the same thing that it always says, which is you never accounted for patient harm. You never accounted for protected health information data loss. And then I think inversely, going way too overboard, and I think this might be sort of like a reactionary response from clients who have received a rejection in the past. They'll say, we want you to test everything on the device. And we go, great, we can do that. And then they say, and then we want you to carve it apart. We want you to, you know, try fault injection onto every chip. We want you to try to break into the debug ports. I want you to dismantle everything, like every single piece. And they go, why? You don't need to do that. It's not a requirement. You don't have to shred this device apart. And they go, well, the FDA says you need to, you know, have a control in place for these things. And we go, yeah, the control in place is someone would need to, you know, take like a crowbar and smash the machine to get to these chips. And I think you'd notice if someone did that. So clients will, you know, and manufacturers, they'll just swing back and forth into each direction. They're not sure where that middle ground is. And that's why we recommend, you know, you have to find someone who knows how to do a medical device, FDA-centric penetration test. And then, like, we know the balance. We know how to get a device. We know what we have to test. We know what the documentation looks like because we've done it 1,000 times. And so it's just a run-of-the-mill process at this point. But, you know, a lot of manufacturers will try to push this off to their internal cybersecurity team. And they're like, oh, yeah, we got through our ISO 27001. We know what's going on. We know what a pen test should look like. But again, it's a different rule. So I think it's a great point about, you need to know what you actually need. It doesn't matter how much someone's offering for the cheapest price. You got to get the best value for the price and the greatest output for that price.
Yeah, I think where education has really failed, at least in our country, is people don't know how to evaluate what value is. Right? Value is not the most expensive. It's not the cheapest. It's not even really the middle of the road. It's when you spend a buck, what are you getting?
Yeah, it's the best.
If it's worth it, right. If it's worth it, pull the trigger and buy it, right? I think just, you know, from an education standpoint, we have a lot of gaps in intelligent, rational thinking that people need to, what I would just say, they need to step it up. And they need to do it on their own. And
that's a whole different issue right there.
It is, right?
That's about personal responsibility and accountability.
We know, both have the security altogether. You know, and it just, there's so much misinformation that is for quote unquote education that people are confused on what is accurate and what's hyperbole. And that's what we're having to do in business is cut through the noise. And at the end of the day, you just hope that the other person on the other end has enough business savvy to filter out the real from the garbage. And there's only so much education you can do.
Yeah, and this is being this misinformation as you used is increasing because we have AI generating content left and right.
100%. 100%.
I think the silver bullet for AI is anyone who figures out how to make an AI say, I don't know. And, you know, if it doesn't know, it should say that. And I think part of why it never says that, though, is how often do you hear a person say, I don't know, and it's trained on what humans say.
Right, right. That's interesting. You know, it's you know, as I'm digging deep into AI, because I'm a volunteer founding member of the AI Global Council. And as we see AI being incorporated into a lot of, you know, healthcare technology and medtech technology, I think we need to be really careful, because at the end of the day, we can teach computers to do many, many things. Where computers will always fail is being able to rationalize, because nothing can replace a human brain from a mindset, not anatomy or anything like that. But again, there's always a human behind the computer, no matter what.
And I think that humans are going to have different perspectives on things where an AI isn't.
Correct. So that's the rationalization, because think of a dog, right? I've got two of them, two big 90-pound labradoodles. They do the same stuff over and over again. It drives me nuts. You would think, because they're a living creature, they would learn, but they can't rationalize. They can think, but they can't rationalize. So, you know, when I tell them to go to their bed and sit, they still do two circles and then sit, doing it all their life. They can't rationalize and go, why am I twirling in circles twice and then sitting? They can't do that, right? The computer can't do that either, right? And so
I think a lot of humans can't do that either.
Oh, that's funny.
It's you do the same thing over and over, expect a different result. You know, it's like
you know what? It's funny you just said that. I just responded to a post on LinkedIn this morning about the definition of insanity. And of course, for me, it's always coming down to commercialization effectiveness, right? Unfortunately, it's mostly commercialization ineffectiveness for companies. But they keep trying to – all these startups and these small, medium enterprise companies keep trying to launch products and services the same way that large, multi-billion-dollar annual revenue companies try to commercialize their products. And the smaller, medium enterprise and the startup world and the startup companies, every once in a while they get very, very lucky. But unfortunately, 72 to 77% of the time, they don't get lucky. And they try to commercialize the same way every time, expecting a different result, and it never changes. I always say uncommon leadership creates uncommon companies that lead to uncommon strategies that morph into uncommon tactics that ultimately lead to uncommon commercialization. And cybersecurity goes into that, because if the product or service has any type of data or online presence or usage, then unfortunately, if they don't take that seriously, they won't end up being an uncommon company having uncommon high levels of customer adoption.
That's a lot of uncommons.
Because it is.
So I have one question for you, Craig. What do you think about the whole Silicon Valley mindset that startups are trying to adopt? Move fast and break things. Just try to get something out, make it happen. Don't worry about the roadblocks. If problems come up, fix them later. How do you think that mindset becoming so prolific in Silicon Valley, in America, in startups everywhere, really, is impacting companies' roadmaps towards proper commercialization?
That's a heavy question, because I could talk for that about 3 hours, especially if I'm on stage, right? I call that the kryptonite in your – that's one of the kryptonites in the business, right? There's never going to be a perfect product or service. However, good enough shows a condition of the heart that is somewhat manipulative to the consumer or the customer that would buy the product. Because if the people that are in the startup world are recipients of good enough, they're not going to like that. So I think it's a condition of character and integrity, right? Not just being the word of the day or the word of the season or the word of the year, but actually doing it and striving for excellence. And people say, well, that can add $3 more million, you know, until we can launch the product. Well, do you want to be good enough or do you want to be great? It is a choice. People say, well, failure is not an option. Yeah, it actually is. It is an option. And unfortunately, people choose that option way too often, not knowing, because they try to shortcut things. I always say, and this didn't come from me, this has come from multi-nine-figure and 2 liquid net worth billionaires that I have relationships with in business that own companies in multiple different industries. And none of them had experience in any of them, and yet they're some of the most wealthy human beings on the planet, which just goes to show you, you don't have to have quote-unquote experience in a widget or you know, sector of an industry in order to be super successful in business. You just got to have wisdom. But they've said, there's 2 industries where speed is critical for businesses to thrive: trauma and motorsports. Any other business, speed will create hastiness, which will lead to ineffectiveness.
Sounds like all the Silicon Valley guys have got to start moving on to Formula One racing.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, unless you're in trauma or motorsports, what does speed do for you but create more challenges that could be, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, unnecessary challenges, right? And so what we're missing in the business world is wisdom. Intelligence doesn't breed wisdom, but wisdom is the proper use of intelligence. And that's what we're missing. We've got all these people with all these educations and MBAs and PhDs, and you look at how they run a business and you put your hands in your head and you go, you're an educated idiot. You're ignorant. You know? And it's like, we have to start using wisdom if we want our businesses to thrive, right? And that includes the products and or the services you guys provide. That's the services I provide and the services other people provide. If businesses want to start thriving, they have to stop doing stuff halfway. It's just good enough and fast, 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 fast.
Yeah.
Because all it does
I think the problems. The angle Trevor was coming from, and I agree with what you're saying, Craig. I think if I'm trying to come up with a new product, and I don't want to get feedback, I think that may be part of the angle he's coming up with. Like, you know, if instead of like waiting to develop the perfect product and the consumers don't like it, if I can have an iteration, get some feedback, and then tweak it and, you know, constantly do that, that makes sense from, I guess it's not really a speed perspective. That's just more of an iterative process though. So yeah.
Yeah, but there's too many founders that are in love with their widget.
True. But if nobody, like you said, from a commercialization perspective, if nobody else wants the widget, who cares if how much you love it?
You are spot on. I literally talked to a VC last month and I spoke with 2 of the founders in one of the portfolio companies of this VC, because VCs are now starting to call me and saying, we need help with some of our portfolio companies. This company has been around for 6 years, but they've been commercializing. They product launched. They launched their product to sell to hospitals and surgery centers and freestanding emergency rooms and things like that 19 months ago. They have less than $100,000 in sales in 19 months. Yet these people came from two very, very large strategics. And these people did really well in those large strategics. But because startups and mid-stage growth companies and small, medium enterprise companies don't have time-tested processes roadmaps, you know what I mean, in place, people don't know what to do. And so the VC managing, the main managing partner of this VC is like, Craig, is there a way that you and your team could come alongside of us and help this portfolio company start getting, we're not asking for high levels of customer adoption. We just need some decent customer adoption. And in lifting up under the hood, I lift up the hood, right? And I started inspecting the engine, just like I was at the beginning of this broadcast. There are some serious kryptonite in their commercialization process. And it's unfortunately not just one or two components of the commercialization process. My suspected assessment is probably 6 out of the 10 are really affected, unfortunately. And so from my standpoint, I said, folks, you're going to need the bridge audit. We're going to need to come in and audit your whole commercialization process and give you a report specifically on in each one of the 10 components where the kryptonite is that's stealing your effectiveness.
I like that. Well, we're coming up on time here, so I like to ask people for some parting words of wisdom. So I'll start with Trevor, and we'll see if he says the same thing he always says. I put him on the spot sometimes.
Well, you know, last time I had to mix it up, but I think that the reason I always go back to the same thing is cybersecurity isn't something you can leave to the end. And it goes back to the 10 components of commercialization. Regulatory is one of them. It's number 3, right?
Yep.
Sure is. There you go. So it's a top priority. Cybersecurity is for regulatory compliance. And the regulations say you need to do it at the beginning. You can't wait until the end. So cover it early, cover it often, and make sure that cybersecurity is at the forefront of everyone's mind as they're trying to build a product. And don't go fast and break things unless you're in trauma and motorsports.
Perfect. All right. What do you got? What's your last, your parting words of wisdom, Craig?
You know, I always, on a regular basis, tell leaders in companies, there's no kind of. You're either effective in business or you're not. Which one do you want to be? Do you want to get it right or do you want to be right? If you want to be right, most of the time, you're going to get it wrong. And just like the Titanic, the water will come up to your knees, but the orchestra will still be playing, saying nothing's wrong. And unfortunately, the boat sinks. And unfortunately, at 5 years, 50 to 55% of boats sink. Boats meaning the companies, right? And 72 to 77% of companies don't even get to blow out their 10th, you know, your anniversary birthday cake candles. And so commercialization is an art. It's not a science, because if it was a science, we'd be able to follow that recipe like a, batch of cookies.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I like it. Well, I'm a founder that wants to get it right, and I'm frequently wrong. So I expect people on my team to have a better idea than me, or a coach of mine has a better idea, to let me know for sure. Because I hope I don't end up as one of those statistics in the slowly sinking Titanic with the orchestra playing.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
I don't want to be in that scenario.
Absolutely. Right. And nobody knows it all. I don't know it all either. Right. Which is why I still pay for business coaching. I figure if Tiger Woods and Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan had sports coaches all the way up to their prime, and then they kept them at their prime, and then when they retired, that's when they got rid of their business coaches. I can do the same thing.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Craig, for being a guest on our podcast. We enjoyed our discussion. And thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in. Hope to see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Med Device Cyber Podcast. We hope you gained valuable insights into the world of medical device cybersecurity. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Should cybersecurity be top of mind for your medical device company and you wish to learn more about how Blue Goat Cyber can help your business, please click on the link in the show notes below to book a discovery call with our team. Stay informed and empowered to protect yourself and the people your company serves. Until next time, stay safe and secure.